And tonight, Linda Moulton Howe joins us with a number of stories of high strangeness. Her first, we'll be talking with her, of course, about the RAF Bentwaters case. She's got more incredible information, so get ready for that. And then the last hour of the program tonight, after Linda goes through her series of special reports, we'll have conversations with Linda right here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. We've got Linda Moulton Howe. You know Linda, of course, award-winning investigative reporter. Her website, earthfiles.com, truly cut to the chase. She has a number of breaking stories on that website. Here she is back on Coast to Coast, one of our favorites. Hey, Linda, how are you?
Well, thank you, George. It is good to be back in the United States because England was so cold.
Oh.
And the fact that John Burroughs, Jim Pennison, and I were able to get there the last week of December and to try to do it under the radar. So the idea was that neither of those men together had ever been back to Rendlesham Forest after the dramatic events of December 26, 1980, beginning around 3 a.m. in a section of Rendlesham Forest, which is near the RAF Bentwaters Woodbridge Air Force Base that was so big back then 30 years ago. And they were out there under orders to investigate highly strange and colorful aerial lights. According to signed and dated statements at the time, John Burroughs and Jim Pennison came close to these lights and a craft of unknown origin, as was written in one of the summaries. Jim Pennison described approaching a 9-foot-long by 6-foot-high triangular object and touching its black, glassy surface. As his fingers went over raised symbols that he compared to Braille at the pointed end of this craft, Sergeant Pennison's mind was telepathically flooded with binary code and some information about the intelligence behind the craft and lights. Airman John Burroughs has never been able to fully recall what happened to him that night, but the rumors have long been that he, quote, either jumped up on a craft in the forest or was taken up in a beam of light. On Christmas morning, December 25th, 2010, only a month ago, I joined John and Jim returning to Rendlesham Forest for the first time together since 30 years ago, and we drove from the East Gate down the same road that they had traveled. The question for both of them was exactly where did they have their closest encounter with the lights? Where did Jim touch that craft? And why don't they remember the same detail? We ended up at the big farm field and Capel Green on the eastern edge of Rendlesham Forest. I had asked my friend and UK engineer Winston Keach to join us with his infrared, night watch, and time-lapse cameras, as well as his tri-field meter, which can measure microwave, magnetic, and electric fields. John and Jim took that tri-field meter out into the farm field after midnight on December 26th, and near a finger of trees that juts westerly out into the field from a farmhouse, the tri-field meter pegged with a loud noise as high as it could go in the electrostatic range. It also did the same thing the next night with John Burroughs and Winston Keach there. Well, in the daylight on December 27th, we returned to the Capel Green area. Jim and John think now they have found the place in Rendlesham Forest where Jim touched the symbols. And you can see photos of our trip, some of the mysterious images we caught on infrared in this report at my news website, www.earthfiles.com. There's a hot link to the full report on the headlines page. I asked John and Jim if they would discuss for Earth Files and Coast Radio their return to Rendlesham Forest and that farm field. Here now to begin is John Burroughs.
The first night, I definitely felt some kind of energy on me, like it felt like it was going up my neck and stuff. But the meter itself pegged out. It didn't move. It was staying strong right in that whole area.
The needle was as high as it would go and did not drop.
Right. It wouldn't drop. It was like it was banging, wanted to go further, and it couldn't go any further, yes.
The next day, we are in the tall trees of Rendlesham Forest. Along that edge, there's Capel Green and a bit of the farmer's field, and then you are in Rendlesham, and that's where we were when Jim seemed to be overcome by a feeling. This is where we were, John. What is it that you felt happened?
Well, when Jim walked away with you to the trees and then motioned for me to come over, and then he showed me where the berms were, and then he said, I remember tripping here. Then I went forward, and then it was like he went into a trance. He started acting like he was reliving it from 30 years before, and he acted like he was walking around it. He was acting like it was there, and he was seeing it, and then he acted like he touched it. And then it almost appeared to me like his whole body shook.
Jim Peniston said his recall was so strong at that moment in front of us on December 27th, 2010, that he could see, hear, and feel what happened there 30 years ago. Here now is what he told me.
We were like within 10 or 15 feet of the craft. When I approached the craft, the physical air and surroundings changed. It was like as if a bubble was around the area that measured maybe 10 or 15 feet out from this craft. Once entered that area, different sensations happened.
Your skin and your hair were affected?
Skin and hair, there was like a feeling of electricity on my clothes too. Deadening of sound. Didn't seem like everything ran to slow motion. The recall was so strong. The fabric of the craft, when I'm touching it, is very smooth. It looks like black glass. Symbols are running 3 feet long, maybe a foot or so high. Then I started touching them. It was actually rough, like the feeling of sandpaper. So I traced my hands, each symbol, just out of awe, not sure what I'm seeing. On the repeat of coming back of these symbols, I get a bright light and I can't see. And I have no other vision and I can't see what's going on around me. I just see these symbols. They start running in front of me and they're fast. They're coming at me fast.
And are you seeing the zeros and ones like they are in the air in front of you?
No, they're in my head. I cannot see nothing except those.
As if the technology has somehow taken over the synapses in your brain in order to place these vivid zeros and ones.
That's when the activation happened, yes. They overrode my vision and everything, yes. That was startling and very strange. It was a very scary moment. You have no control what's going on.
And then what happens?
Seemed like it was given to me very fast. Then I got the bright light again. And that's when the coding stopped. I go back home and I finally get about 4 or 5 hours of sleep. But I'm awakened, you know, because I just can't get these symbols out of my head. Almost like they're going crazy. I mean, you know, I know I had a shock. I know it was trauma. I'm wondering, am I okay? Why would I have these rushing through my head like this?
The zeros and ones.
Oh, yeah, it was just unmanageable. It really was.
In your head, were you seeing color?
No, they were black and white. I grabbed my notebook again because I wanted to look at the symbols I recorded.
And you mean that panel about 3 feet long and about 1.5 feet high on the glassy surface that were triangles and circles in those odd patterns?
Right, and I had recorded them on my notebook, and I was just going back looking at the next day, and I still have these ones and zeros in my head. I mean, it's just like it keeps repeating. So I said, well, I could write those down. Maybe it'll help to write them down. And so I just flipped the pages open, and I started writing more in the notebook, and then all of a sudden they stop. I don't have any more. I don't have any more symbols in my head. So you stop. I go, is that easy? Just write them down. They were gone. I didn't have to worry about the symbols. They were just gone.
As John and I watched Jim moving and talking in the Rendlesham trees, John suddenly thought he saw some kind of energy around Jim, and then it was gone.
And then at that point, I had a weird feeling that the whole energy source was gone. And I made a comment right afterwards, the energy source, I think, is gone. And then that night, Winston went back out in the field, and it was gone.
And the next morning, what did he tell you?
When I saw him in the morning, he was totally shocked. and he couldn't believe that there was no energy force.
Winston checked it with the same trifield meter that on the night of the 26th, we got the pegging. And now suddenly, after midnight on the 27th, he walked all around that finger of trees and he could not get any high reading anywhere on that trifield meter.
Right. No, he couldn't get any readings. And one thing that I'd said earlier to him out there, I said I felt it move back towards the coast.
And I was running his IR camera. When you came back, I remembered that you said it looked like I saw a blue light in the trees.
Right. It clearly looked like for brief seconds that you could see like almost a little blue something floating along into the finger area and even starting to go out into the field, yes. There's an energy source out there. I'm not telling you it's ET or what it is, but there clearly is some kind of blue type energy picked up on camera. What that means, I'm not sure, but there's no doubt in my mind there's some kind of energy field or source out there in that field, in that area.
When you were walking with Winston around the far western point of that finger of trees on the north boundary of Capel Green, as you walk around those trees, you enter that huge field.
Right. What's interesting to me is that energy field's still there.
After all these years.
After all these years.
But why would it go away on the third day and night?
I honestly don't know. I mean, it could be coincidence that I just felt it, and it could have been farther back by the house. It could be a shifting field. I really can't explain why I got that feeling other than just the way Jim was acting and just the feeling I got afterwards. But I can tell you this. I believe it's still there. I just believe it moved back further, and I believe if you went back out there and looked, you'd find an energy field still out there somewhere in that area.
There has been a lot of interest and controversy about the five scan pages of zeros and ones that Jim never mentioned in 30 years until we were filming in Phoenix on October 2nd of 2010. And you were shocked, I was shocked, when Jim said, I remember writing down zeros and ones. What was especially interesting to me was to go back to his 1994 hypnosis session and realize that he mentioned the intelligence people who were putting him under sodium pentothal hypnosis sometime after December 26, 1980. They asked him, as if they already had some other knowledge, they asked Jim Peniston about binary code. But over the 30 years, Jim never said that he wrote down zeros and ones. What was your reaction to the five scan pages that he's provided?
Jim never approached me and said he had written anything down. The only time Jim talked anything about having any problems, this happened on Thursday night and the Friday morning. Then Friday night, they had another incident into Saturday. Then I was back out there on Saturday night with Colonel Halt and Sunday morning.
December 28, 1980.
Right, December 28th. On that Sunday evening, on our last day of break, and Jim had been gone, I went down to his house to tell him what had happened on that Saturday night with Colonel Hall, to tell him you wouldn't believe that more stuff had happened. He just seemed shook up. He just said that he was having feelings coming to him and things that he couldn't understand, and it was bothering him, and it was the kind of things that he didn't feel comfortable with because it just wasn't normal. That much I remember. But at no time did anything come up with, I'm writing down zeros and ones or anything like that.
Did you and Jim Peniston ever get together after Sunday night, December 28th, 1980, to discuss what had happened on December 26th, 1980?
Other than when we got called in, when we returned back to duty and had to write statements and turn them in, other than that, we didn't talk about it. It was making him very nervous and upset because what he was feeling wasn't something that he could explain or understand. And that's as far as Jim had ever mentioned or talked to me about anything that could relate possibly to the codes, other than on that day when we were filming and I saw in his notebook the zeros and ones. And I'm going to be honest, I had no idea. I've heard of binary codes as far as I understood they had something to do with computers and computer programming, but I honestly didn't know anything more about it. So I was completely taken aback that the fact that he'd written something down, number one, and number two, I honestly didn't understand how important it was as far as what could come out of it. I understood that he had clearly written something down, but as far as what it meant, I had no idea at that point.
The one that Dr. Drew and Dr. Reed think is most logical is the one that seems to be very close to the center of Woodbridge. Some people have even suggested that if you all were dealing with some other intelligence in some kind of a probe or craft, it may have been a signal that Jim picked up that related to where it was near Woodbridge, England.
The thing to me it's important now is to identify what the energy source is, to see if there's anything else out there in these coordinates that mean anything, to maybe go to something to see if there's an energy source there. I understand everybody wants to speculate on could it have been contact, and I'm not against any of that. But what's important to me is to see if there's anything that's important within these 24 locations, not worry about is it ET or what else it could be.
Well, he's got a good point there, Linda.
Yes, and it is quite fascinating when you look at a summary, which I provided in this report, of what the options are from the stream of binary code, the zeros and ones that Jim wrote down in his notebook, because there is no designation for a decimal point. How do you find the latitude and longitude combination precisely without a decimal point? So Dr. Drew and Dr. Reed, the astronomer and the retired scientist in Australia, who we have worked with now, and they came up with this location table for binary codes showing all of the possibilities that there could be if you just say, okay, if the decimal point were here in this latitude and it was here in this longitude, and you just keep doing that, you just keep going through the numbers painstakingly, you come up with 24 options, one of which is Woodbridge, England. Now, why I think that is especially interesting is when you go to Jim Peniston's 1994 hypnosis that he did two different dates with a very good hypnotherapist in Illinois, and there was a session one and a session two. And in session two, of which I have some excerpts in my book, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2, High Strangeness, he's under sodium pentothal hypnosis. He's in a room where clearly, as far as he was concerned then, and is especially now, these were National Security Agency, MI5, MI6, these kinds types of people. And they have him under, and they're asking him questions. And one of the answers that Jim gives is, quote, they are time travelers.
Sure.
They are us.
Some people have always suspected that.
Right, and that would make that black glassy thing probably some kind of a time travel machine, and it would make sense, right, that it would always be sending out coordinates where it was on any planet.
They'd have to.
Well, it becomes extremely interesting, and you can see this entire excerpt from this hypnosis session in my Earth Files report tonight, because it is quite fascinating to see that when he's asked, what is it that they want, that they are gathering chromosomes, some kind of genetic material from Earth, to be taken back to whatever time period they are coming from to use as Band-Aids. This is in the hypnosis, to use as Band-Aids. And they are having problems, quote, the program, I understand what they are saying, but they weren't supposed to be there. They are having problems. The odds are against them. And then Peniston explained that the chromosomes were gathered for different reasons, particularly to help the time travelers because they have a physical problem. And he felt sympathy for them. Peniston said the time travelers have, quote, been coming here for a long time, at least 30 or 40,000 years, trying to sustain their children in the future. He explained that the children have hairless humanoid bodies with pale skin and very large eyes. And, quote, when he was asked by the Intel people, is this going to have any negative effect on us? No, it won't hurt us at all. And if they can't get these chromosomes, what will happen? They will die, close quote.
What a story. Up next, more with Linda Moulton Howe as we investigate the deaths of so many creatures on this planet. Why? Well, are you a Coast Insider or StreamLink member? You can be for just pennies a day and get all kinds of neat little benefits. Just go to coasttocoastam.com. You can sign up for being a Coast Insider. Lex sent me an email today. He's been dealing with our IT folks, and he said it looks like the Android apps will be coming out sometime next month. So let us keep our fingers crossed on that one. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM with Linda Moulton Howe and more of her investigative stories. And welcome back. We're with Linda Moulton Howe. As you know, several weeks ago, we started reporting on a bizarre story of birds falling dead in Arkansas. Linda Moulton Howe has been following that story and so many stories like that now, and she's here with her report. This is a weird one, Linda.
Well, it is. And if you go to Earth Files, I have done a list from December 2010 through January 24th. And I have approximately now 24 line items or 26 line items of different dates of different events that are dramatic around the world in both hemispheres. And one of them in December that I'm going to be talking about with the UK investigator is back to more of those corkscrew sliced seals washed up in North Norfolk. They thought it had ended, and it has not. And that, in a way, is sort of to me like the beginning point of this arc of all this Earth life death. Because through December, until we get to New Year's Eve, there really was a lot of death from New Zealand in the Southern Hemisphere, where it's been summer, to the Northern Hemisphere in Labrador and in Ozark, Arkansas, where some 100,000 of those drumfish died, the only species in the Arkansas River, and no one knows why. Then when you get to the night of 11 p.m. Central, in Beebe, Arkansas, on New Year's Eve, 5,000 at least red-winged birds and starlings, some witnesses reported they dropped out of the sky. And necropsies have confirmed that the birds showed no signs of disease, no toxins, and what they died from was, quote, blunt force trauma. And I talked with the veterinarian, the state Arkansas veterinarian, and he said the beaks were broken, the necks were broken, the chest bones were broken, and there were internal hemorrhaging and smashed organs, which means that those birds really slammed hard into something. Well, there was all that controversy about residents who were hearing loud booms, and the media said that authorities were saying it must be fireworks,
yeah.
But there are all kinds of mixed signals here. And one of the men that I talked to is a meteorologist at the Little Rock Plymouth State Weather Center, and he is the one who reported that on a radar return from exactly 10:59 p.m. on December 31st, 2010, there is this light green circular spot at 1,400 feet on the NEXRAD image. And you can see this in my Earth Files report. And I put a little yellow arrow so you can see what he's talking about. Well, this little greenish mass at 1,400 feet did not have characteristics of precipitation, and it did not move. Now, if it was the big flock of the birds, why did they leave the trees where they would nest at in the dark? They don't see well, and it was raining. They'd had thunderstorms going through that night. The thunderstorms were now to the east. And then residents said that they saw the birds flying into car windows and house windows near the ground. Well, did the birds fly into something at 1,400 feet and then drop to the ground? This is really, truly kind of a mysterious association of events. The loud booms were heard in half a dozen states, and then you move 3 days later on January 3rd, and we're down 350 miles south in LaBarre, Louisiana. And there were about 500 birds that were found below a power line. And I've talked twice to Dr. LaCour, the vet on that, and he said they do not have toxins. They do not have disease. It appears that the birds all flew into those power lines in the dark and dropped down to the ground. Now, if you then say what happened between December 31st and now, there were dead bird reports coming from Texas, Sweden, Faenza, Italy, those turtle doves that were found hanging upside down in trees south of Venice, California, Alabama, and even China. And at the same time, there were hundreds of snappers and 2,000 penguins in New Zealand. There were 10,000, perhaps 23,000, according to the latest news out of Vietnam, of cattle and buffalo, water buffalo, there freezing to death, all adding up to highly strange weather around the world, which I'm going to talk about in the fourth segment tonight. But when we come back to this issue of what could be happening to all the birds, I think one of the most distressing pieces is that the U.S. Department of Agriculture finally fessed up to having a program in which they use a compound called DRC-1339, Starlinside, and that they, on January, make sure I get this date right, I think that this occurred, I know it was reported, the deaths were reported on January 22nd, and I think that they had put this out 10 miles south of Yankton, South Dakota, the day before, and all of these birds, there were 2,000 starlings that were found dead in a park in Yankton, South Dakota, all deliberately killed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And you can't help but wonder, even though we've had toxicity reports back that say that nothing was in BB or in Labar, the very fact that our own government is killing masses of birds on purpose to get rid of starlings, what other kinds of birds could end up eating the same poison bait? I mean, that is a serious question. And as we come through to the most recent deaths that include whole bunches of birds in China that may be related to cold, we have a global dying off at the beginning of the new year, which is not a good sign. And then what is happening again in Norfolk, England, that we would have reports of these strange spiral slices? It started back in July of 2009. I interviewed one of the veterinarian pathologists at the UK Sea Mammal Research Unit in August of 2010. That's when, between Scotland and Norfolk, England, they had a total of 57 of these spiral slice seals then. And then there was some kind of a stop. They hadn't found an answer. They couldn't find a machine, no technology. The Greenland sharks were dismissed. And then, a month ago, in December 2010, more strangely cut bodies were found in North Norfolk. And taking over the investigation now from the Norfolk Police is Deputy Chief Marine Officer Neil Wellham. He has worked in British marine biology since 1987. He told me he's never seen anything like the seal slice in spirals before now. And I talked with him recently about his investigation from his Newcastle upon Tyne, Norfolk, England office. Here he is now.
During December 2010, four more seals were reported being washed up on the shore between Hunstanton and Cromer on the North Norfolk coast of England. And that has been the first recurrence of such deaths since August 2010, after which they had ceased to occur. So we had a gap from August 2010 to December 2010 where the problem appeared to have gone away, but now it has started to recur again.
I remember that in December of 2009, it was the North Norfolk beaches that the corkscrew slice seals were being reported then.
That's correct. We were tracking this problem from December 2009 to August 2010. We actually took over responsibility for coordinating this investigation from the Norfolk Police, who had been investigating it up to that time.
What have you done with the four December 2010 bodies?
They've been being autopsied and post-mortemed by the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, the RSPCA. So we have been working closely with them on cause of death. From our point of view, we're looking at 41 seal deaths from December 2009 to August 2010, the majority of which bear the corkscrew injury, and a further four where we're still looking into it. One of those has now been confirmed as having the corkscrew injury.
Okay, so at least 42 corkscrew-sliced seals on the northern coast of Norfolk, England, plus an estimated 16 more seals reported to the UK Sea Mammal Research Unit in Scotland. That's a total of some 58 seals sliced in the strange spiral cut since 2009, and you have necropsies still ongoing in the four seals found on North Norfolk beaches in December of 2010. I wonder, in terms of the one that has been confirmed with the corkscrew slicing, I had interviewed a veterinarian pathologist, and they were describing the corkscrew slice as either stopping midway on the body of the seal or going from the head all the way to the tail. Do you know the nature of the current corkscrew slice on one of the December 2010 seals?
Not at this stage, but I can confirm that we've seen the corkscrew injury going from head to tail and also a shorter distance from midriff to tail.
I have eight photos, and it is so thin, the seal blubber skin, it reminded me of an apple core. Would you agree?
That's a good description, and what has been interesting about a lot of these injuries is that no bones are broken.
As of August 2010, no one had been able to find any kind of a matching ship or any underwater technology that could explain this blubber-high deep corkscrew slice. What is the investigation now on what could be doing this?
Well, the Sea Mammal Research Unit, which is based at St Andrews University in Scotland, has done some work on this and produced a report, and they are hoping to do some further research early this year. Their suspicions were that this could be caused by a ducted propeller system whereby the seals are being drawn through that. And these propeller systems in some cases also have a knife cutter which is designed to cut through rope if it gets around the propeller. And some of the injuries on the seals were almost a reverse template of the knife cutter on these propellers. But we're having to keep an open mind. This hasn't been confirmed yet, so we haven't ruled out any other possibilities that it might be caused by a natural occurrence or a man-made activity or possibly even criminal intent. But at the moment, my guess is that this is probably being caused by human activity. We have yet to get to precisely the bottom of what that might be.
Back on August 24th, 2010, I interviewed Dave Thompson, PhD, senior research scientist at the Sea Mammal Research Unit in Fife, Scotland. And at the time, they had looked at several of the seal bodies. And when I asked him what could make this corkscrew slicing, as I've just asked you, he said that they were trying to find some sort of a technology or ship or boat in the sea, but that the truth was that by August of 2010, they had not been able to find any technology that would match the surface slicing of the seals. There has been no confirmation of a match with the technology to the corkscrew slices, has there been?
Not at this stage, though. There is a suspicion as a result of the research that it could be caused by this ducted propeller type arrangement.
Yes, that's what Dr. Thompson said on August 24th, but he also added that in terms of mechanical devices on the seabed that could make these corkscrew cuts in the seals, no, we are not aware of anything at all. So this, to me, is still a part of the story that no underwater technology has been found to match the corkscrew slice cuts on the seals.
No, I think that's correct. We've been working closely with an offshore wind farm construction operation, who is perhaps the nearest significant activity other than normal vessels, if you will, and they've been fully cooperative in our investigations, but we are still no closer to actually confirming the cause.
And from your perspective, sir, in longtime work having to do with marine management, what is your personal opinion about a phenomenon that has been going on since at least perhaps the end of 2008, but certainly since 2009 through December of 2010, that would have so many bodies and still nothing matches the corkscrew slices?
It is difficult. It is something we are going to maintain an interest in until we can resolve it. We'll be remaining vigilant. I think what has happened since August 2010 is that all the different people who have been working on this issue and looking into it, the Sea Mammal Research Unit, the police, ourselves, the RSPCA, our nature conservation advisors, we're all working and sharing the knowledge together. So the hope is that we will remain vigilant. And if these deaths are reoccurring in the similar pattern to last year, I would hope that we can make some positive progress. It is important that we try to get to the bottom of it, because in the context of North Norfolk, it is actually a European marine site of special area of conservation. And one of the features for which the site is protected is the common seal, one of the species that has been being harmed by whatever it is that's causing these injuries.
And it's true, isn't it, that historically there has never been such a corkscrew slice seal found in Norfolk before April of 2009?
That's my understanding, yes. It is an injury that I've not heard of before.
And that even makes the mystery greater, doesn't it?
I think it does. But we will certainly not let go of this as long as it takes.
And George, if you look at that photo that I have at Earth Files, it's one of the better ones from one of the necropsies, where you see what a perfect spiral is going down the whole body of that seal, and it's thin.
Oh, the seal itself looks like a corkscrew, doesn't it?
Yeah. And some of them, I have another photo in which the blubber and the skin was, we'll say, peeled off all the way up to the head. And in others, the spiral starts at the nose and goes either halfway down the body or all the way down or some variation, making that really mysterious. And for people who say, well, it must be the Greenland shark. Well, I've done quite a bit of research about what happened in the early 90s in Sable Island. That is a very thin little island about 300 kilometers southeast of mainland Nova Scotia. It's in the Atlantic Ocean. There's only five people who are mostly like science types who are there. And the Sable Island Green Horse Society did their own investigation, and they reported back in March of 2003 about the early 1990s strange sort of spiral cuts on some of the seals there that people were speculating maybe it was this Greenland shark. But in their own report, they said, quote, of the various wound patterns seen in the seal carcasses washed ashore on Sable Island, by far the most common is a peculiar, clean-edged spiral cut, which is quite unlike wounds characteristic of attacks by great white tiger, and they named other animals. And they ended up saying that until our actual attacks are witnessed and documented, the role of the Greenland shark in predation on seals around Sable Island will remain a matter of speculation, not proven fact.
Linda's uncovered even more with the honeybee stories. That's next on Coast to Coast AM.